Today's Teisho will be on case 30 in the Blue Rock collection, Joshu's A Big Radish. Main subject. A monk asked Joshu, "I have heard that you closely followed Nansen. Is that true?" Joshu said, "Chinshu produces a big radish." Secho's verse. Chinshu produces a big radish. Monks have taken it as their model. They know only how it was and would be. How can they realize the swan is white, the crow is black? Plunderer, plunderer, the monk had his nostrils threaded through. Today is the second day of our October Sesshin. I could almost say our August Sesshin, and I could almost say our June Sesshin. This is becoming more and more like California here. Pretty amazing weather. Very, very nice, don't you think? So everybody did a wonderful job again this morning in their sitting. I'm especially impressed by the people who are here for the first time. I remember my first sesshin, and it was an extraordinary ordeal. I hadn't practiced very much. At that time, Genki Roshi had just come to the United States. My first teacher was a monk from Ryotakuji in a temple in Japan. And he had come to the United States at the invitation of the man who later became my second teacher, Kangan Webb. And they had run into each other in Japan, and second teacher was an extraordinarily kind and self-effacing person. And he had gone to Japan and trained with a number of teachers and received Dharma transmission. But he didn't really feel that he was cut out to be a very good teacher. So anyway, he invited Genki Roshi to the United States to be the head of a Zen group that Webb had basically built up. And Genki came to the United States and wanted to start doing sesshin right away, because sesshin are the heart of Zen practice. You really must practice regularly if you want to make progress in Zen. So if you sit 4 or 5 times a week, if you make that your goal, that would be a good foundation for your practice. And then maybe, I meant 4 or 5 times a week on your own. And then if you could sit maybe once a week at the university or at one of our other places, and then doing Saturday sits whenever you have a chance, you'd be really training well. But there's nothing like sesshin for deepening your practice. This is unlike anything else people do, so far as I know. And you can't duplicate the depth of mental clarity, mental focus and clarity in any other way that I know of. So sesshin is absolutely crucial, and of course Genki understood this. So no sooner did he come to the United States than he decided to have a sesshin. Now, I had been reading some books on Zen, and I had gone to a Tibetan center in Seattle. And it was on 45th Street near the university. And it was a beautiful place. In Zen, all of our colors are sort of dark, you know. Our cushions are black, the robes are blue. It's very, a lot of wood. But the Tibetans, you know, they have like scarlet and yellow zabutons and rose-colored walls in their Zen hall, in their sitting hall, rather. And everything's very colorful. So I went into this place and thought, oh, this is so beautiful, you know. And I was, but there was no resident teacher there at the Tibetan house. So I would just go and sit myself. And I was having a lot of problems with stress and so on. And it would help me just to go and meditate. I'd read some books on meditation practice. But I ran into somebody at this Tibetan house who said that a monk had just come from, a Zen master had just come from Japan, and that he was teaching at the university on Wednesday nights. He was holding sits. So I went to sit at the university, and I have to tell you, just getting through, I think we did three sits there, but they were about 25 minutes apiece. Just getting through those sits was murder. I would, you know, barely make it through, and so I think I'd done this for 2 or 3 weeks. And basically, after going to sit at the university, I would go out with a friend of mine and have a big glass of beer after each a sit. And that would sort of like undo all the whatever I had achieved at that sit. And then I'd get up the next day with kind of a little bit of a headache or something from this giant mug of beer. I went to the university one night, and one of the leaders of the group was a woman named Wendy Nicow. And she was a friend of Webb. And Webb had brought Genki Roshi over to run the Seattle Zen Center. And Wendy was, a very good organizer. And she was getting everybody ready for sesshin. So she announced the sesshin during the sit, and then she, afterwards, she was asking people if they were going, and she came up to me, and she was this beautiful Japanese-American woman, and she came up and said, "Are you going to this sesshin?" And she had this beautiful smile, and I just looked at her face, and I said, "Yes." I had no idea what a sesshin really was, but okay. So I went to the sesshin, and I must say I wasn't prepared, you know. It was absolutely murder, right? I mean, first of all, Genki was used to training in Japanese temples, and so he assumed that our basic sit would be 45 minutes long. And he just let it be known that the sit will have 45 minutes sits. You know? And I think he thought he was being easy on us, too. I'll never forget, I can't remember if I saw Genki Roshi at the university or not. I guess he did come to sit a couple times, but when I got to the sesshin, he was mopping the floors, you know, and I that left such an impression on me because apparently everybody said he was this great meditation master, and you know, he didn't drive up in a stretch limo or something like that, you know. He was mopping the floors in the zendo when I came in. So when we had our sesshin, it was in a place actually smaller than this, with more people. And there was a kitchen off the main sitting room, and there was no door, so the cooks had to be very quiet, and you could hear them cooking, you know, but they did try to be very quiet. And at night, there were rats in the building. So you could hear these rats squeaking and tussling. And so So it was quite an interesting experience, the whole thing. I didn't have to go through very many 45-minute sits before I went into a kind of shock, you know. And it was just, I started out with like maybe like a half lotus, but by the end of the first day, there was no posture left, you know, that was comfortable. Right? They were all like torture. Right? I think it was probably around day two when I got to go into Dokusan. And in our temple, in our tradition, at that time, in a classical Japanese temple, when you do Dokusan, you actually sit seiza style with your legs under you. Yeah. There was a cushion there, and I tried to sit seiza, but that was just so awful, and I was sort of like trying to sit seiza, but I was leaning so far forward, you know. And Genki Roshi, he was a very kind person, and he said, you know, please just make, you know, be comfortable. And I think I almost cried, you know. So I got on the cushion, and he just, you know, it was like he was reading my mind. He said, I know you're in excruciating pain. But he probably wasn't reading my mind. It was probably so obvious. I remember he was just very reassuring and kind, and I made some lifelong friends at that first sesshin. A bunch of people who went to that first sesshin kept doing Zen practice. We've all been practicing for 30 years, and I've had lifelong friends. I remember when we would have a break, and we could, you know, after a meal or something, go out and. This was in a very nice place over a body of water, and there was a porch in the back of the room where we were sitting. And I went out there once, and right after we had a sit. It was like just before Taisho, right? So I went out in the back, and there was this guy there, this sort of seedy-looking guy. He had sort of, like a longish hair, I don't know, he just looked seedy somehow, you know, and he was smoking cigarettes, you know, and his fingers had tobacco stains on them or something, I guess, from smoking so many cigarettes. And his name was John Sunston. He became one of my best friends, and he was out there chain smoking cigarettes, and he too was in agony. You know, I tried to hide it, but he didn't. It would be like when it was time, he'd go, I can hear his voice. He'd say, Spellmeyer, I think I'm going to die. And, you know, we had these rats in the kitchen, and one thing that impressed me about Genki Roshi, besides his great kindness, was that, and besides his mopping the floor, when we were all sitting in the zendo the first night, and the rats came, and they were squeaking, and next day in his teisho, Genki Roshi said that, if this had been a traditional American, you know, somebody would say, oh my God, we've got to get the exterminators out here right away, you know. And Genki Roshi said that he was really from a part of Japan that was very rural. And he said that where he was from, rats were seen as a good omen, because if a rat lived somewhere, it must be a pretty healthy environment, must be a pretty decent place to live. So he said, naturally, we don't want to hurt the rats. So he said, we just have to make sure that all the food is covered up and they can't get to it at night. So that was very interesting. I just thought, you know, who is this guy? And so his compassion extends even to rats, you know. And anyway, the session was like 7 days, I think, or 6 days. And we stopped doing, mercifully, nobody would have been standing if we had kept doing 45-minute sits. So we started to do 25-minute sits, and that made it slightly better. Right? But it was just an unforgettable experience. You know, in those when Genki Roshi came to the United States, the Seattle Zen group was very small. But this was the 60s, or really this was not the 70s, the end of the 60s. It was 1970, I think it was 76, 77. And, you know, Seattle was like a hippie mecca, right? So, you know, when I first walked into, when I first came to Seattle, I wasn't born there. But, you would walk down the street and there'd be all these girls with the peasant blouses on and long flowing hair and, sort of peasant skirts. And people still used to wear blue jeans with the colored patches on them and stuff. It was just beautiful, you know. And so, anyway, when word got out that there was going to be a Zen master who had come from Japan, you know, man, people, we probably had 45 people at this session. It was maybe more, you know. And a lot of them had never done Zen, and a lot of them were like hippie types, you know. So I swear to you, if you don't believe me, send an email to John Sunston. There was a guy who came who actually had like a pyramid, you know, and he put it on his head. If you think I'm making it up, I swear. I'll give you John Sunson's email address. You can email him, you can ask him. And he called himself Joshi. At this time in the New Age circles, pyramids were supposed to be very powerful. People actually wrote books that said pyramid power, the secret of the ages. And the theory was that if you could get under a pyramid, it would generate this tremendous energy. So this guy actually brought a pyramid and put it on his head. And, by the way, I swear this is the truth, honestly, this guy who called himself Joshu, also, at one point he was sniffling in the Zendo, and which is hard to help if you have a cold, but he was... And, of course, the person who was in charge of the Zendo called the Jiki Jitsu. The Jiki Jitsu said, stops! This is not a good way to do things. But in Japan, the Jiki Jitsu was like the drill sergeant, right? You know, so the Jiki Jitsu said, stop sniffling! You know, and it was Joshu. And Joshu said something like, I'm doing the best that I can! And then he said, and that's the end of it! And then he said, and also the beginning! Right? Honestly, I swear. So I have the greatest, it was the greatest experience. He also tried to ask a question during the Taisho. He said, excuse me. And Webb would translate for Genki Roshi, he said, we don't allow questions here. And he was okay with that, we didn't get it. But when he said, it's also the beginning, literally the place broke in the The last night of the session, in classical Zen training. The last night of session works like this. In a Zen temple, on the last night of session, you're not allowed to leave until the senior people, the persons who are senior to you, leave. So at 10:30, Genki Roshi got up and left, right? And then Webb left. And in a true Zen temple, you couldn't leave until all the people... So if you were a monk or nun with 7 years under your belt, you couldn't leave until all the people with 8 years had left. So what this means is that the novices, the unsui, the cloud and water people, wind up stuck there pretty much all night, right? And so the last night is like all-nighter, basically, which I don't think is very productive, let me say. So at this session, we didn't have a mandatory all-nighter, but we were invited to stay up. And the people who stayed up, Joshu was there, right, with the triangle, with the pyramid. You know, and it was like a rogues gallery of people staying up at night. One guy just had a poncho on and he just walked up and down, you know. So it was like insane. But that was my first sesshin. And after doing that, I went home and I slept for a week, you know. and then school had started again, and I went to teach my class. And one day I was in the classroom, and I just turned to write something on the board, and my mind went, it was the most amazing thing, it went totally blank. It was like, I had no idea, you know, what I was going to do next, or it was just amazing, you know. But somehow that sesshin just stayed with me. You know, the experience of being in sesshin gripped me in some way, and it might not grip you that way. You know, if this is your first time and you've been here for a couple of days, you might say, "Well, this isn't my cup of tea." You know, but for some people, this is really a powerful experience, and it can really grip you somehow. You know, there's something, I mean, I was in pain almost the whole time. And I was not used to getting up at 4:30 in the morning, right? And I think we had so few bathrooms, it was amazing. It was like, you just sat there and waited for the bathroom to open up, right, you know? It was inconvenient in every possible way, and there wasn't enough food either. You know, basically we weren't really prepared, I think, very well for a group this size. And you know, when I went home, I my mind was just sort of blank. You know, it was just a. There was a teacher who came to the United States. At the turn of the 19th century, his name was Soyin Shaku, and he was asked to give a talk on Zen to a conference on world religion. And all of these people gave these learned papers, and Soyin Shaku was a Zen monk, Zen master. And he started off by saying, "You know, modern people don't know how to be dumbfounded." And the audience burst into laughter because they thought it was a translation mistake. See, they thought, naturally it's very important to have a mind full of ideas. See, they're all there at the conference taking notes and getting fresh ideas. And Soyin Shaku came and said, you know, the real problem with modern life is people don't know how to be dumbfounded. But at the end of sesshin, I was dumbfounded, you know. I was hearing the wind and tasting the soup without a screen, a film of ideas and conceptions between me and reality. And it was a wonderful experience, even though I felt like I was going to go to the hospital, you know. Joshu, for those of you who are here for the first time, I often find it inspiring the people who are pretty young come to sesshin. People in their early 20s coming to sesshin is really inspiring. And some people here are even younger than that, you know. Joshu was 17, maybe 16, when he started doing Zen practice. So he was, that's very unusual. You know, most people don't have the emotional and maturity to do this when they're very young. But Joshu started doing Zen when he was quite young, maybe even 15. And when he was 17, he had a great awakening. He had not a great awakening, but he had a kensho, an awakening experience. And some people might just say, well, I've had my awakening experience, so that's out of the way. But Joshu said, God, that was great. You know, every once in a while, we're so hemmed in all the time by our fears and our preferences. You know, I like this, I don't like that, I'm afraid of this, I hate that. You know, we're so hemmed in, we get so caught, and we can be profoundly unhappy. You know, I mean, I have to say that I wasn't an unusual person. You know, but I had, you know, my share of unhappiness. I think that's why I went into to investigate Zen, because you just get so tired of being unhappy, having no energy, just being sort of gray, and, you know, life is just nothing. You know, it's just not alive. It's basically just a trudge. And you say, how did I get like this, you know? Joshu went to a Zen temple and had this experience that maybe some of you have had here. You know, where you're sitting on the cushion and suddenly you feel this tremendous sense of opening. It's like suddenly, you know, all your cares go away and all your worries and your concerns, and you're just happy to be in the moment, you know, just happy to be watching your breath. And this seems so stupid, right? And it's so stupid just to be happy with the light on the floor or the call of the crows, right? But, you know, somehow when we take away all of these obstacles, life is just, you know, unspeakably beautiful. It's just, it's like life is pulsing through every atom of the universe. You know, really, if you do Zen long enough, that's how it's going to be. It's like everything is alive. You know, everything is alive. So anyway, Joshu had a little taste of this. Maybe he went to a sesshin, and when he was 17, he had an experience of what life could be like, you know, if we can just free ourselves from our karmic obstacles. And he had a breakthrough. Maybe he was sitting on the cushion and he just felt like a 1,000 pounds was taken off of his body and felt connected and alive. And he said, oh, this is fantastic. Who can teach me more about this? So he asked around, and somebody said, you should go study with Master Nansen. So Joshu became Nansen's student, and they studied together for many, many years, you know, like 50 years. See, people think Zen is about, people get interested in Zen, myself included, with this idea that I'm going to really throw myself into this, and after 3 or 4 years I'm going to have Daikensho, you know. But if you keep practicing, you realize that not only is that not going to happen, but you don't want it to happen. Because there's no end to the opening up of life. Your experience of the world can get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Maybe in these 2 days you've had an experience where for just maybe 10 seconds, you know, your heart has been at peace and you felt connected to the world. And maybe it was a whole sit, maybe it was an afternoon. Maybe it hasn't happened yet, but I promise if you keep practicing, it will happen. So Joshu had that kind of an experience, and he went to study with Nansen, and they studied together for 50 years until Nansen died. And everybody said that Joshu should become a great Zen master, a great teacher. And he said, well, not yet. I'd like to practice some more first. So he hit the road in China. He went out on the road in China, and he went all over the Middle Kingdom looking for enlightened people. And he met many great Zen teachers, and he went to temple after temple. And he had wonderful experiences. He didn't start teaching till he was like, you know, 80 years old, 85 years old. And he's supposed to have lived to be 120. When he was 100, he invented the Mu Koan. Okay? So, at any rate, when he was in his traveling period, he already was famous as a great, deeply awakened person. And he had a reputation as somebody who could have been a big superstar, you know, but who was still traveling the country basically with his backpack on his back, you know, and staying at these temples and doing sesshin with all these different teachers. But when he would come to a temple, people would challenge him. You know, young monks would think, so, you're the great Joshu, you know. Maybe they had this idea that he would be, you know, sort of levitating across the room. And in comes this rather goofy-looking monk, you know. Joshu was supposed to be rather tall. Rinzai was very short, and Joshu was very tall. So, you know, he was probably kind of heavy, tall, you know, kind of heavy-set guy, maybe not very impressive to look at. And people would say, oh, so this is the great Joshu. So some monk comes up to him and says, basically, in this koan, a monk said to Joshu, I've heard that you closely followed Nansen. You're supposed to be Nansen's best student. Is that true? So in a way, the monk is sort of needling Joshu or challenging Joshu. And Joshu could have said, you know, oh yes, I was his best student, you know. Or he could have said, you know, something defensive. But instead, what he says is, Chinshu produces a big radish, you know. That's like the perfect answer. Because he's not trying to get even with the guy. He's not trying to defend himself. He's just opening up the situation so that both of them can enjoy the beauty of the moment. Chinshu was a place in China that made the radishes, like we have daikon pickles in the morning, right? And they grow apparently big radishes in the Chinshu. This is not really just about a radish, though, you know. Every time you encounter a barrier in the world, you can respond to it in different ways, you know. You can, you know, you can walk away from it. You can try to crash through it with all your might, or you can hate it. You know, you can curse it. You can weep. You know, you can despise yourself. You know, we all encounter barriers in life. You know, some of them are, you know, like wanting to get the job of your dreams, and you go for the interview and you blow the interview. You come home and you can say, oh, the guy who interviewed me, what a bad man. You know? Or you can say, God, I'm such an idiot. I hate myself. Or you could, you know, get drunk, whatever. You know? You could say the world stinks. It's painful and difficult, right? Well, in Zen practice, we also encounter barriers. You sit on the cushion and you say, okay, this is going to be a nice, peaceful sit for 25 minutes. And then 7 minutes into the sit, your knee starts screaming at you and your mind is hysterical, right? And you can sit on the cushion and say, I hate it, I hate it, I hate this. This is a bunch of crap. Why did I come here? You know, I hate everybody. I hate my mother, my father, you know, I hate everybody. I hate myself. You know, damn it all to hell. That's it. Damn it. You know, or you can say, I'm no good. I'll never wake up. You know, or you can say, Ring the goddamn bell, you phony. You phony. But if you, you know, there's another way of dealing with a barrier where you you start to empty out. I don't know how to put it any other way, but you know, if you watch your breath long enough, your mind becomes blank. You become dumbfounded. Yeah? And if you call Mu long enough, you become dumbfounded. And when you're really dumbfounded, you know, you just disappear. It's like you disappear. And in Zen, this is called dying on the cushion. When you die on the cushion, you come back to life in everything around you. This is a great secret. You know, there was actually, in the Middle Ages, there was a teacher whose name was Meister Eckhart. Meister Eckhart was a Dominican monk who was probably executed by the papacy. He was a teacher, though, in Northern Europe. And he used to say, if you know how to die to everything, you can live in everything. See, now he had it. He knew. He was awake. When you encounter a barrier in yourself, nobody likes a barrier, right? We want an unobstructed vista in all directions. And when we encounter a barrier in ourselves, we can get mad, we can hate ourselves, we can feel pity, we can feel blah, blah, blah. But if you sit on the cushion and you watch your breath or you call Mu, sooner or later you're going to be dumbfounded and you start to empty out. This is called dying on the cushion. And when you die on the cushion, as I said, everything around you comes to life. Everything comes, sooner or later, everything comes to life. See, and this process never ends if you don't want it to. So you could do Zen for one sesshin, 100 sesshin, 1,000 sesshin, and I promise you, it's never going to be dull. And there's always a barrier, right? And they change all the time, but life is very generous in providing us with barriers. And when you encounter the barrier, you see yourself like in a mirror, right? You know, I've had people come to sit at the university on Thursday night or Monday night. I've had people come to meditation on a Monday night, the beginner's class, and leave furious. Really, it doesn't happen often. But every once in a while, somebody will come and you can see they're really pissed off as they leave. And it's striking, you know. They don't like that barrier. They don't like that barrier. But if you learn how to die on the cushion, you know, everything is so alive. You know, everything becomes so wonderful. And the world gets bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, our fears, our attachments, our mental fantasies, our culture makes the world smaller and smaller and smaller. But if you follow this path of Zen, bigger, 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 big radish. How big is a radish? It's really big. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Really big. So Joshi's saying, look, my friend, you know, You can hate me, you can like me, whatever you want. And you have all kinds of ideas about enlightenment, you have all kinds of ideas about life. It's a big radish, you know. Let's just sit on the cushion together and let's die on the cushion together and come to life together. Yeah? So that's what Zen is all about. It's day two. A lot of people feel like dying on the cushion, maybe. You know, legs hurt. Pack is tired, maybe you have a cold. But you know, that's really like, if you're sitting there and you're feeling miserable, that's a barrier, you know? And it's your golden opportunity. Really and truly, golden opportunity. There's no other way to liberate yourself than to confront your obstacles. And the barrier's really in you. It's really in you, it's not really in your circumstances. It's not in the, you know, structure of the sesshin. It's not in your cushion. It's really not even in your, it's in you. When we face the barrier, we look in a mirror, we can see the unpleasant side of ourselves sometimes. You look in the mirror and you see your anger, you see your fear, you see your self-loathing, you see your laziness, you see whatever, envy. And that's so purifying, right? And so you just see your obstacles and you keep calling moo or you keep watching your breath, and little by little you start dying on the cushion. And then boom, beautiful open horizon. You know, it stays open for a little while, and then, you know, our habits kick in again. But it's back to the barrier. And it's so wonderful, so wonderful. So please, today, please face your barrier. Yeah? And nobody likes pain, but everybody has pain. I have pain. And let me say, I've been doing this for 30 years. And I can sit for a long time, but I still get pain. And if you're sitting on your cushion and you're thinking, you know, that your pain is unique, it's not. Everybody feels pain, naturally. Your legs get tired. But, you know, if you keep going into your breath, you keep going into move, that pain is going to be very unimportant at some point. And you're going to find kind of joy that's not achievable in any other way. So this is maybe day two is kind of a hard day for people, but I promise you, if you practice with an open heart, you won't be disappointed. A monk asked Joshu, "I have heard that you closely follow Dansen. Is that true?" Joshu said, "Chinshu produces a big radish." Secho's verse, "Chinshu produces a big radish. Monks have taken it as their model." That's what we're here for. We're here for the big radish. "They know only how it was and would be." In other words, they have mental obstacles. They have expectations. They're finicky, like my cat, Isidore, right? I like this, I don't like that. He says, the monks want to have a big radish, but they have too many obstacles. They have to work through them. How can they truly realize the swan is white, the crow is black? In other words, this world is beautiful, is perfect, just as it is. You know, it's our mental obstacles that make us think otherwise. And then plunderer, he says, Joshi is a plunderer, thief. See, so basically that's a compliment. In Zen talk, when you say somebody's a blockhead, a thief, a corrupter, you mean he's a wonderful person. Okay? So the monk had his nostrils threaded through. You know, you put a hole in a bull's nose to put a ring in there. So you put a hole in his nostrils. So he's saying Joshu really kicked that guy's ass. But see, Joshu didn't kick his ass. That's not what Zen is about, right? Joshu threw that guy a life preserver. See, he said, "Listen, pal, let's live in this beautiful world together. Now, who cares about me? Who cares? Let's die on the cushion. Let's have a beautiful life. You know, it's such a beautiful life."